Oh yeah. Oh yeah. Bring it to me. Welcome, y'all! Oh, that's right. This is a Pregame Engineer Tailgate Mare Racing Podcast, episode number 113. It is Thursday, September 21st, 2017. I'm Tailgate Mare Rusty Laws. I'm joining PTM Podcast Studio with Pregame Engineer Andrew Sherwin. What's up, dude?
Feels like we hadn't done this, like, ever. I'm starting over from scratch.
It's a little...
I started in a bad spot, so this might be bad for our listeners.
So, yeah, it's been a few. It's been a minute, man. It's been a minute
and a half a minute for sure.
Oh, man. Well, before we get too far, let me go ahead and tell y'all that this week's show is brought to you by our official sponsors at the $5 and up per month level. That's Catherine Kingston, Ashley Stang, Harry Balzagna, Mark Wiley, Craig Smulders, Lori Sutton, Mick Rose, Craig Smulders. No, I already said him. Robert Keplinger, Tony Salt, Comey McClam, Eric Kenner, Ryan Kiefer, Marion Levesque, Patrick Cleary, Aaron Bearden, Jeff Brown, and welcome to PTM Posse, Chad Sterling.
All
so
right, Chad.
Thank you, Chad. You're the man. As always, this podcast is sponsored by you. You go ahead and go to patreon.com/PTM. Join the What's Drinking Club for as little as $1 a month. We'll send you that free koozie. The best part is, every cent in 2017, we're donating to sponsoring drivers. So join the PTM Posse today. Be a part of the sport you love. So let's get this going, man.
We have... like NASCAR Media's wordsmith
joining us.
And not only
some days.
Not there he is back in the background. We're gonna introduce you in just a second.
Did we forget how to podcast?
No, we maybe.
Yeah.
Maybe this is just the fun of rejoining podcasting.
Yeah.
Nate is gracious enough to join us for a second time.
Second time.
So now let's introduce tonight's
guests. You know what we say about returning people. That means we didn't offend them too much. And so we're happy to have him back. Tonight's returning guest. He's the host of NASCAR and NBC podcast, writer for NASCAR and NBC, and y'all know him. It's Mr. Nate Ryan. What's up, Nate?
Doing well. How are you guys?
We're doing awesome, finally.
Probably too awesome.
Yeah. Finally back in the saddle here. I keep saying that, but y'all, I think we've... said it on Twitter. Well, kind of alluded to it on Twitter and stuff. I just wanted to say real quick, in PETM fashion, if you will, we were going to Darlington. We had, the truck was packed. We are getting in the truck. We're ready to go. And I unfortunately received a phone call that my grandmother was in poor health and pretty much I needed to be at the hospital right now. And on my way to the hospital after figuring all this stuff out with Sherwin, she passed. And so, you know, it's something that it's a real tight knit family. It's, you know, it's one of those where you, when you're that close with somebody, it's that much harder when you're losing them. And our family's all really close. So, that happened and, you know, all this crazy stuff and then can't podcast for a week and a half. Then we try to podcast Sherwin and Hurricane Irma comes through, and that's a pain
insult
in the butt.
To injury.
So in PTM fashion, though, I'm going to raise a glass and take the hat off for Mrs.
Absolutely.
Ruby Loretta Christopher, my grandmother. Drinks up.
Cheers to you, Miss Ruby.
And cheers to my grandma, and we'll bring it back. We're not going to be sad and all that this whole podcast.
No, that won't even be the first one of these in this episode.
I know, right?
To be honest with you.
Right? Well, we already cheers without doing anything but or without talking about it, but... you know how we start this thing, Mr. Nate. What you drinking today?
I don't drink on the job, so I would consider this part of my working obligations today.
You're
so
not...
I don't have anything in hand, sorry.
It's all good.
I raised one to your late grandmother, though, and condolences on her passing.
Oh, I appreciate that.
I hope you're writing this hour off as an hour of work.
Yeah, right? Better.
This is supposed to be fun.
Better be getting paid, and don't send us the bill. Yeah. We lost the checks in the mail.
Yeah,
it'll be
definitely
there.
Definitely send NBC the bill.
Well, we're going to get into our, you know, usually we do the car number right here, but we've got a little bit to talk about with that, and figure we just go ahead and start by tearing it down, breaking this thing down, figure out what's going on in the last few weeks, Sherwin, that we've been out and about and hurricaned and everything else. So let's tear it down. Y'all, I texted Sherwin earlier this week, Sherwin, and I said, where are we even going to start?
I don't even.
It ain't in the pre-show.
What are we going to leave out? I think very, is really.
Yeah, yeah. In the very brief pre-show, Nate said, "Oh yeah, I hadn't done anything for 2 weeks. Well, nothing happened." yeah, I hear you. So, what to say? I mean, silly season, penalties, all the crazy stuff going on. We did have a race this last week. Nate, why don't you give us your sort of take on this race, what that means? I mean, holy crap, anybody who was talking about Truex is in a poor light or whatever else is eating those words, huh?
Yeah, I mean, he was obviously the favorite entering the playoffs, and he did nothing to dispel that notion on Sunday. And I think the fact that they were able to overcome a couple of mistakes of their own doing was impressive. And I think, you know, Letart said it on the podcast today. I suggested that maybe Kyle Busch finished 15th with the fastest car. And Letart said, I don't even know if that was the fastest car, because when Truex was in traffic, he was able to fight through and get back toward the front and overcome the hole that they dug for themselves. Whereas Busch, when he got lost in traffic, I mean, he was battling Austin Dillon just to be the free pass car and struggling to do it. So I think there were a lot of signals that Martin Truex Jr. remains, in my mind, he's the favorite to get to Miami, not just because of the playoff points, but because of the way he runs. But mm-hmm. I think if he gets to Miami, he's not necessarily the favorite. I've been saying that. I feel as if he is definitely the favorite to get to Miami. But once he gets to Miami, I'm not sure if he's still the favorite, particularly if Larson is there.
So you think Larson is – well, I mean, obviously the way he runs and that high line and all that sort of
right.
stuff. So if Larson gets there, you think he's there. Who else would you put or if anybody would you put ahead of Truex at Miami?
You know, I think you could put a few guys. I mean, Truex has run well in the past at Miami, but not so much recently. And you know, that team, it was interesting last year. They didn't even test at Homestead Miami Speedway, which was very curious to say the least. And it ended up really not mattering because they didn't make the final round. I'm sure they're going to test this year, and that test is next month. That'll be critical, but. I mean, I think I would put Kyle Busch certainly ahead of them. I'd put Harvick in front of him. I mean, virtually anybody who's won at Miami, I think at this point, could be considered to be stronger than Truex at that track. And I'm actually writing that, working on a column right now for tomorrow, in which Dustin Long, my colleague at NBCSports.com, got some quotes from Cole Pearn and Martin Truex Jr. during our NBC sit downs after the race. And you might have heard this, but Larson in the NBC interview post-race said that Truex might win 9 of the 10, but if we get to Miami, we feel like we've got a shot. And we asked Dustin asked that of Pearn and Truex both, and he got interesting answers. I mean, they kind of laughed when they heard it, and they didn't totally refute the notion that they've got some work to do. So you know, I think that might be if you're looking for a sign of hope to take away from a victory by Martin Truex Jr. by 7.1 seconds or whatever the margin was, that might be it. I don't think that's necessarily a sign this is going to be a complete runaway blowout.
Sean, what's your take on that race?
Well, so I thought – here's what I thought. I thought Truex overcoming the penalties that he overcame and the misgivings that he had on pit road, I thought were very level-headed or mature or whatever you want to call it. But I only had those comments after I saw other people have very similar incidents and react very differently and have very different finishes.
Yeah.
I think it's pretty obvious that Truex at that kind of track has a package and a driving style that's going to give him a tremendous advantage as long as they don't hurt themselves.
Okay.
So there is one of those tracks in every segment. He could win all three of them and wind up in Miami at Homestead and have a chance to win it all. And I think that would be a pretty cool situation if he did.
Well, yeah. it would be new in this era for sure. Let's just keep going. You know what? Before we keep going, I didn't even talk about what we're drinking. Sherman, what you got there?
Okay, so I try to do my due diligence, Nate, just so you know. We have a fantastic couple of stores where you can buy adult beverages down here in Atlanta. And I wanted to buy something that was New Hampshire related because we're going to New Hampshire.
And I was able to find it. I was actually standing right in front of it when Google landed on the brewery that is probably the most popular, at least from a Google perspective, not necessarily locally. So New Hampshireites, I'm sorry if you don't like the beer I'm about to announce, but I am having a Finest Kind IPA from Smutty Nose,
Smutty Nose
Brewing Company in New Hampshire.
Sweet. Nice work. I just happened to pick up this Radler from TW Pitchers Brewing Company. I don't even know where they're at. I should look on here. Well, you'd think they'd say where they're from. Oh, San Francisco, California. There you go. So, yeah, the Radler, the lager with grapefruit. So,
enjoying that.
New York City, San Francisco, California. So let's keep tearing it down with this silly season. I mean, so this week, pretty much announced Casey Kane to the number 95 for Levine Family Racing. Keith Rodden's out as crew chief for this the remainder of this year. Darren Grubb is in. Nate, is this just kind of a Hail Mary right here at the end of the season? We got to do something now. So throw in Darren Grubb, see what happens.
Well, I'll just continue shamelessly plugging my podcast here. Please. Hard, but, I mean, he's the expert, and we talked a lot of Hendrick Motorsports during that podcast that came out. And, you know, I was curious about this move as well, and I think some other people were. Like, why would you make this move with nine races to go when you know the driver is leaving? You know, why change out the crew chief, especially after they won Indianapolis together? You figure they made the playoffs. They've at least earned some dispensation to be able to finish the year together. And I thought it might be because they're looking to finish as high as they can in the points, and Chicagoland was a dismal, dismal weekend. I mean, you could see the frustration with Casey Kane all weekend. He didn't get out of the first round of qualifying, which is abysmal. Parker Kligerman, you know, one of our pit reporters and NASCAR America analyst, he was saying on NASCAR America that he had the Kane pit stall, and so he talked to Rodden and Kane throughout the weekend, and he could see it on their faces. But you would think that they would still maybe at least get a chance to finish out the year. And I mean, Letarte didn't think so. Letarte thought that this was a decision that was probably made before Chicagoland, that they were going to make this change, and he thinks it's all about next year. I thought it might be that maybe they might want to finish higher in the points just because there could be a little bit extra bonus money. Unfortunately, we don't really get to see the breakdown in point money the way we could pre-charter system, but I thought there might still be something to play for in terms of that, where they want to get the best finish they could, and they figured like this pairing didn't work anymore. And Letarte made a really good point that by putting Darren Grubb in charge of that team for the final nine races, he gets to assess where that team is at and get it in a workable state come February when William Byron jumps in the car. You know, he made the point, Steve made the point, that you don't want to just turn over a number five team that ends the 2017 season in potential disarray to your young, you know, kind of cornerstone of the future here in William Byron. I mean, they've got a lot riding on him. So I thought, you know, Steve knows Hendrick Motorsports as well as anybody, and I think that makes a lot of sense as to, you know, why the team would make that change. It's all about looking toward 2018 and trying to get the right people in place for next season.
Sherwin, what's this mean for us fans?
I think what it means is we should probably just be patient with what Hendrick has decided is the right thing to do to get the five ready for it to become the 24 for William Byron, and understand that as Casey Kane fans, we do have an option next year. We don't have to hold that ultimate frustration of the driver's gone without it being his decision.
Yep.
And he's not in the sport anymore. Like we're going to get a chance to root for him next year. I hate it for Keith Rodden. But as a listener of the radio for the last 3 years, every single race weekend, whether I'm at the track or I'm at home, I hear the same things I heard that got Kenny Francis moved to a competition position, which is the guy on the box asking the driver what he wanted to do.
Yeah.
And that's not what Chad Knaus does.
Yeah. Yeah. It's crew chief more than consultant, I guess, where we're going.
Yeah.
Yeah. Continuing along, let's keep talking silly season. This is crazy. Danica Patrick, Eric Almirola, Matt Kenseth. Nate, where are they going to be?
I think in one of those cases, in Eric Almirola's case, it looks like a Stuart Haas ride next year. And the other two cases, for Danica Patrick and Matt Kenseth, right now it feels like there's a better chance than not that it could be end of the line and Cup for both of them.
That's crazy.
Yeah, I mean
it is. I mean, when you think about like the final 10 races of Dale Earnhardt Jr.'s career, also could be the final 10 races of Danica Patrick's career. It also could be the final 10 races of Matt Kenseth's career. And that to me is really interesting. And I think maybe it's going to dawn on us more as we get toward the end of the season. And if nothing shakes out for Matt Kenseth, I mean, when you look at Matt Kenseth and Dale Earnhardt Jr., like two careers sort of in parallel, you know, they virtually entered what was in the Busch Series, now the Xfinity Series, together in 1998. They entered the Cup Series together in 2000. Matt Kenseth was actually Rookie of the Year, despite Dale Jr. winning twice in his rookie season. And now it appears they might exit together as well. So there's a certain sort of symmetry there, which is interesting, but probably much to Matt Kenseth's chagrin. I think he would keep racing if it were up to him.
Well, you know, it's a great point. I saw a photo earlier today that kind of made me laugh, but almost made me kind of slump a little bit, because it was Dale Jr. And Matt Kenseth in, I believe, 99 or whatever, when they were finishing up their, at the time, Busch Series campaigns. And Jr. looked like this very chiseled, hard-edged, you know, the face was very chiseled, he had a very hard look. And Kenseth looked like a freaking teenager.
Yeah,
he does have a baby face from back then.
Yeah, back then he did, for sure. And yeah. It's like, wow, I don't remember Kenseth that way, but I think that's mostly because we didn't really get super hardcore into being NASCAR fans until 04, 05, 06, call it whatever you want,
then. And so I think a good point there, too, is that there's not this swan song for these folks. Like, Danica Patrick's not having the retirement year or the see you later, or you know, and especially somebody like Kenseth, who, I mean, he's a champion.
Certainly deserves it.
Yeah.
That is what's kind of sad. That's Sherwin, right? I always feel bad when I address you guys. That was Sherwin who was just talking.
That was Rusty who just said that one. It's all good.
Sorry, Rusty.
No, we grew up, we tell guests all the time, we grew up in suburbs of Atlanta, and sound pretty similar in terms of accent.
The cadence is pretty similar.
Yeah. So it happens. It's all good.
No disrespect meant to either of you. But
Germans bombing Pearl Harbor.
That is the sad part about this, I think, for Matt Kenseth. Because you're right. I mean, Jeff Gordon, Tony Stewart, Dale Earnhardt Jr. get these elaborate season-long send-offs that they're completely deserving of for the impact they had. And I don't think Matt Kenseth necessarily would want that, you know, being that he's the reserved Wisconsinite who prefers to keep everything low key, but he deserves it. And, champion, he's going to be a Hall of Famer. He hasn't won in more than a year. And a lot of that isn't his fault. Some of it is just the team wasn't always up to par. They made some mistakes. I think he's going to win again. I think he could still win the championship. And, you know, that might be the best way at this point for Matt Kenseth, not just because he'd be going out on top, but if he's able to go out with a championship despite not having a ride for next year when he is still completely able. And the only reason it appears he doesn't have one is just because there isn't sponsorship and there isn't a team willing to take a chance on a guy who's an elite-level driver. I think that would be a way that would like maybe be a salve for some of the I'm sure the bitterness that he's going to feel if he doesn't get to go out on his own terms.
You know, and you reminded me of a stat there that he hasn't won in over a year. Think of how good he was throughout last year and especially year before that. And to not have a win in a year, I know we use the term silly season to talk about what happens during the off season, but it has felt like a silly season of NASCAR racing, hasn't it? I mean, Joey Logano without a win, and Kenseth without a win. We've got these cucumbered wins that we keep talking about.
Well, Joey's got one of them cucumbered ones.
But,
I mean, it doesn't matter now. I want to thank you, Nate Ryan, for bringing up the fact that Kenseth could possibly win this championship because the situation, the cloud around him in terms of what his ride is and what it's not going to be next year, I would love for that that controversy to happen for NASCAR because I think it would be a fun conversation.
I mean, I'll admit, like, Matt Kenseth is one of the guys I like covering. I have a pretty good working relationship with him. So, I mean, there is a little bit of sentimental side of me, but I root for storylines. And to me, that would be one of the best storylines because, yeah, he would essentially just be sticking it to the man, in a sense, in the establishment and telling them, like, hey, no one wanted to take a chance on me, and now I'm going out on top and kind of, like, just, you know, putting the lie to, like, all of these you know, suggestions that somehow I'm not capable of being an elite ride anymore. It would remind me a lot of, I think it would be maybe most analogous to like 6 years ago when Tony Stewart won his last championship in 2011, knowing that he was working with a lame duck crew chief and Darian Grubb, that Darian Grubb got fired with like six races to go that season, and yet they still won a championship. And that was the most awkward championship press conference probably in NASCAR history. And I suspect that if Matt Kenseth were to win the title, you would see probably a reprise of that.
Yeah, I think that would be great. Especially because, you know, Matt, he's so dry. He's going to come up with so many one-liners to fit the narrative and make everybody go, damn it.
Kurt Busch, is he a story or not, Nate? Is it like... When should we be looking for, well, he signed again for at SHR, or is there a story there?
I think, you know, the longer it goes without us hearing news about it, the more it's going to be a story.
Yeah.
Particularly if he struggles. You know, the opener didn't go the way he wanted at Chicagoland. He ran well throughout the race, and he was coming off that you know, strong performances at Darlington, and I think he ran well at Richmond as well. I mean, that team was coming in with some momentum. And they ran well for most of the race at Chicagoland, and then I think it was loose wheel, or he thought he had a loose wheel on the final run, and it caused him to go a lap down because then he was speeding in the pits. So they got off a little bit on the wrong foot, and if for some reason they weren't to advance to the next round, I don't think it's likely at this point. I think he's, you know, the odds are still in his favor, but then I think it probably gets a little bit more unsettling. I mean, we've heard nothing to indicate he's knocked me back. Like, the team, Tony Stewart was on NASCAR America this week and addressed the future of the driver lineup at Stewart Haas Racing, and he said they still expect Kurt to be back. The reason they didn't pick up his option is because the sponsorship wasn't there to sustain him at the contract level, you know, the salary he was going to renew at. So they didn't pick up his option for that reason, but they're still hopeful that they could work something out because they're expecting, I believe, Monster to come back. But yeah, until that happens, I think it's natural we're going to have questions about it.
Yeah, well, hopefully they don't sign a Bobby Bonilla-type contract, but maybe something in between that and what Kurt was going to make.
Blaney Dopinski, as I'm just going through all this stuff that's going
on.
Oh,
yeah, we've
talked about that.
This is what. So, unfortunately for you, Nate, we've taken so much time off. There's been really awesome things that have happened that we haven't had a chance to talk about.
I'm trying to summarize
how
them
cool,
all here.
The Blaney to the 12. You have a rolling bullet session.
Yeah, I've got them here. Just bullet points.
Yeah. I'll try not to talk too much about them.
Oh, no. Blaney Dopinski, you know, that I find that to be really intriguing myself. Maybe of all the ones on here, besides maybe Kenseth not having a ride yet, but Blaney Dopinski is really, I don't know, that's crazy to me. And along with that, you know, Menard over to Wood Brothers. So that's those are some, I don't know what to say about them. That seems like a huge deal. Ryan, is that as huge as I'm thinking it is? I don't know. I'm lost for words.
I think the Penske part of the equation is interesting because it'll be the first time in, 8 years that they've had three cars at Penske?
Yep.
And it seemed like as soon as they dropped down to two cars, that was when things really started clicking at Team Penske. And, you know, Keselowski won a championship the second season after that, and then they added Logano, and they've been a powerhouse pretty much ever since. I mean, they've had some slight drop-offs, but it was never the way it was in the late 2000s when they had three cars. They struggled a lot. And if you talk to some people in the organization from back then, I think they felt as if it was because of the three-car arrangement, and there was always sort of one car that sort of felt like it was off on an island. Now, I think they wouldn't have made this move if they didn't feel like they addressed all that and they felt like they could do it seamlessly and stay at the level of results that they're currently getting. But to me, that's the thing that'll be interesting to watch here is as Penske goes back to three cars where they were never really successful as a three-car team. And some of that could be attributed probably to driver lineup and where the cars were. Certainly they weren't at the level that they're at with Keselowski and Logano the last few years, but it'll be interesting to see when adding Blaney in the mix if they can get three cars in the playoffs, because obviously that's the goal. And I think that would be a first for Penske to have three cars in.
What do they got to do different than what they had done before?
I think they've already solved some of it. Like the problem was back 10 years ago, before Penske melded its IndyCar and NASCAR operations together and put them all under one roof. I think it was difficult for the entire organization to get on the same page in the way that they built cars. And I think they put a lot of people into management roles there that have kind of streamlined the processes and made it more of an assembly line type, like a Roger Penske type, Detroit factory assembly line production. So I think that they've put a lot of safeguards in place that they probably are not in the same place that they would be the last time they tried to run three cars. But you know, until it happens, I mean, it'll be interesting to watch. There are some people who think in NASCAR that you either want to be a two-car team or a four-car team. That to be in the middle in that nether region, you're always going to have one car that lags behind everybody else. And I think if you look at Ganassi, and if you look at Penske's successes as two-car teams, I think that there could be some merit to that.
Well, Sherwin, did I miss anything? Except for everything else that probably happened in the last 2 weeks?
Yeah, well, so I guess the thing I wonder about is, you know, when Penske was having a lot of success early in the 2000s with Rusty and Ryan Newman, and they were partnered with Jasper on that 77 car that was sponsoring Jasper Engines or whatever they were doing over there, that yellow 77 car. And I wonder, you know, so that car wasn't having a lot of success, but damn, Rusty and Ryan sure were.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't necessarily personally question whether or not they can run three cars. I always question whether Sam Hornish was the right person to jump into a cup car with essentially no experience at any other level as a stock car driver. He's since proven his merit at other levels.
For sure.
Which is awesome, because I always wanted to root for Sam, because I feel like, man, you know, Defiance, Ohio, Sam Hornish Jr. It feels American as hell. We want somebody like that in NASCAR, especially from that region. But I don't know. I'm looking forward to Blaney being in that 12 and seeing what it can do.
I am too. Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. That's enough looking back over the last few weeks, I guess. Let's look forward. We got a couple questions from folks. Mick Rose, thank you, Mick, as always, for asking a question here. And this one might have been asked before Chicago when we were supposed to do a podcast and then got Irma'd out of it.
I think this is more recent than
okay,
that.
Okay.
I've asked them all to reboot.
I got you. Yeah, because it was we were supposed to do that, and then power went out is what it was.
We were supposed to have Weaver, 2 weeks ago on a Monday?
Yeah.
And it didn't.
Yeah, it was last Monday.
The
studio
was blank.
It was crazy. Yeah, no power whatsoever. Anyway, Mick Rose at GoDucks42 underscore Mick. What are you expecting from, because it says Chicago here is the reason I said that, but expecting from Chicago, Loudon, Dover as far as stages in round one, 7th to 16th, only separated by 10 points. That could change either way. Each stage, points matter is what he says. I think that echoes what we've seen with this playoff / chase format before. What is there anything different this year, Nate, that maybe throws a wrench in it in your mind? We've talked about Truex already, but he just went out and won him a race anyway.
Yeah, you can advance him to the next round. Well, I think Mick's point is well taken as far as points go. I think that really changes the game. I mean, look at Kyle Busch. He, as we said, he finished 15th. And he actually increased his cushion on the cut line on 13th versus when he came in, because he had that many playoff points in the bank. And, you know, that many guys at the bottom rungs of the playoff ladder right now ran fairly, mediocre to poorly at Chicagoland. So I think that does change the game. I mean, you can look and say it's obvious what four drivers absolutely need to pick up their performance. I mean, it's the four guys at the bottom more so than ever before. Whereas, you know, in past years where there was no playoff point dynamic. Guys came in with bonus points because of wins, but it wasn't nearly the same type of structure that it is now, where you have much more of a cushion because of the playoff points, which, by the way, I think is good, because I think the less situations like Truex getting knocked out by the blown engine at Talladega, or Jimmy Johnson 2 years ago, the broken axle seal freak failure at Dover mm-hmm. that knocked him out of the first round. Last year, William Byron, who in my mind still should have been the 2016 truck champion, but gets taken out by an engine
yep.
problem at Phoenix. You know, I think it's good that playoff points guard against those scenarios and ensure the drivers who have earned the right to be in the playoffs and earned the right to advance do.
Yeah, I like the way you put that a lot right there, where there's that buffer cushion to shield the guys who've done really well, and the guys who haven't in the regular season, they got to work a little harder. So yeah, I do like Sherman. You like how that's playing out,
or perform better. I mean,
yeah, or perform better.
I mean, you know, that whole work hard thing is going to go by the wayside because we know they all work their asses off. But yeah, that perform better thing.
Yeah,
like
yeah.
Okay, so now we have a different thing. We've had a different thing for, 13 years in Cup, and now just the second year in Xfinity and the Camper World Truck Series. But you know, go out there and run better. Go run better.
Yeah, yeah.
Because, you know, we've seen an 11th seed win March Madness
mm-hmm.
in recent memory. We've seen 8 and 4 and 7 seeds win in the last 10 years. Go out there and work harder.
Yeah, yeah. Nate, I'm wondering if you – have you talked to any crew chiefs? I know the drivers, crew chiefs, et cetera. If you ask them, hey, what's your strategy for the for the playoffs? Win races. You know you're going to –
you did it. Everybody's done it.
Yeah, everybody does. it's win races. Have you – and you don't have to name names, of course, but have you talked to anybody off mic or anything who kind of puts together maybe a realistic scenario of, you know what, in round one – if we have top 15s, you know, that's where we're aiming. Yeah. If we in round two, we want top 12s, et cetera. Have you talked to anybody who kind of lays it out like that at all, or is it just win and blow the engine if you have to?
Well, you know, it's like you just said, Rusty. I mean, nobody's going to say that on the record, but privately, I think there would be crew chiefs who will tell you that, and I think if you just sort of read the comments from Adam Stevens, or if you would have been with us there, the group of us that were talking to him in the pits after Chicagoland, it was a different demeanor, obviously, of a 15th place finish in the opener than I think it would have been in previous years when Kyle Busch doesn't have however many playoff points mm-hmm. he had going in, I think 23 or 24. He had a significant number. He was second in stage wins to Truex during the regular season. So, again, they had quite the cushion, and they know that a 15th place in the opener is not going to be a death knell by any means. They could finish 15th in the next two races and they'll be fine. I mean, I did the math for Truex versus previous seasons, and granted, it's not completely apples to apples because there were no playoff points in previous seasons, but if you extrapolate out like the number of playoff points he has entering the playoffs through, and then figure out where he's going to finish each of the three rounds to be on the cut line based on where it was in points the previous three seasons, I mean, I think he could average like 28th the first round. Obviously, that doesn't matter anymore because he's advanced. Yeah. I think he could average like probably like a 20th in round two. And round three, I think he could get by like with an 8th to 10th finish and probably
and guarantee it,
be
right?
safe at, yeah. at making it Miami. And that's why I just think he's a virtual lock for the championship round.
Mm-hmm. I agree 100% on that. I mean, hashtag 100%, like we like to do our drinking game on
yeah,
on
yeah.
the whole I'll podcast handle. But
yep.
Yeah, I think you're right. I think as we go, the less they have to do in order to get to the next round, right? Because there's less people there. I think you have to.
But the competition is.
If you throw wins tougher. Away, then it's hardest to get from round one to round two if you're not winning. Well, Truex has already won, so we'll throw that out.
I feel like round one, though, is more don't mess up.
Yeah.
You know,
well,
don't.
You guys raise a really good point because it gets interesting where if there's like a major upset and somebody with a significant amount of playoff points gets knocked out in round one or round two, and then somebody without a lot of playoff points somehow sneaks out of the first round or the second round, then it does get a little bit easier for the guys with a lot of playoff points because they come in with an even bigger margin than the guys who are still eligible toward the bottom of round two and round three. It's one of those things where I just keep telling people we're not going to fully understand this thing until it unfolds for the first time, which is why this year is going to be cool to absorb.
Yeah, certainly.
I think that's very fair. I guess what I was going for, Rusty, is if Kyle Busch has the same moment the next 2 weeks that he had at Chicagoland, he's still going to transfer.
Sure.
Even with the screw-ups.
Sure.
And I think what Nate was saying is, and I agree with this, is the closer you get to Homestead, the more that mistake is going to matter.
Yeah. Yeah, I think we were saying the same thing.
I think we were. Yeah.
It's so all good.
In my head, my brain just like locked up. And I'm like, aren't you saying the same thing he did? Yes, I'm saying the same thing you did.
So let's move on. Other question from Andrew Kansian.
Kansian.
All right. At Kansian, Khantzian. Question of the week for him. With the financials of the Farmers Insurance deal getting released in a lawsuit this week, how do you see sponsors getting value on their investment, and can we improve on that? And I unfortunately have not seen all of these numbers and everything, but
they're big.
Nate, what's the story?
Well, lawsuit filed, so some numbers came to light. I think Bob Pockers, ESPN.com, wrote the story first, and you know we learned that for, I believe, roughly two-thirds of the season in 2014, Farmers Insurance was paying $16 million to sponsor Casey Kane for about two races. It broke down to like about $660,000 per race was the asking price.
Wow.
And granted, that was a few years ago, and we'll see how that changes going forward. And you know, in relative to the silly season, we heard Dale Jr. addressed this earlier at Watkins Glen last month when he was asked about how things are going to change with the driver shuffle. And he put it fairly bluntly but accurately, and you know, I appreciate the insight and candor on his part. I mean, the guys that Hendrick is hiring to drive its cars next year, and William Byron and Alex Bowman, they're going to make a fraction of what Dale Earnhardt Jr. and Casey Kane made. Because obviously you get paid commensurate with your experience level and results, and those guys don't really have any. And that's a savings to the team, and that's going to change, I think, the sponsorship situation a little bit. And that was a complaint. If you go back even like 10 years ago when the country was in the first throes of the recession, teams were nervous back then about how much drivers were being paid, because it was essentially a 30 to 40% line item in the team budget was going to one guy, and that was the driver.
Wow.
And I think as this driver evolution happens, and we see NASCAR and the Cup Series trend younger, and guys coming in, Cup drivers like an Alex Bowman or William Byron making significantly less than the guys they're replacing, that's a savings for the team. I mean, there's a lot of value there they're not going to have to chase, I don't think, the sponsorship money that they did in the past.
That's as much as we hear from everybody that we talk to that's in the competition about the cost of racing. That seems like a good thing to me.
Yeah.
So I think...
I mean, not good if you're a driver.
Well, sure.
No, definitely not good if you're a driver. So, I mean, if we're just speaking from, like, personal perspective, or I'm speaking from personal perspective, I think that's the reason why Casey Kane just inked a deal with Levine Family Racing, is that his salary's paid for. Like, Hendrick is already paying for his salary, despite the fact that Levine is going to continue their relationship with Richard Childress Racing in terms of engines and other help, whether it's chassis or whatever. They don't have to pay for his salary. That's why Michael McDowell's out. It's like, you know, the people that are hollering and pitchforking on Twitter don't seem to understand that that's actually a big number. And I don't know what Casey Kane's salary is. I don't need to know. I know it's a big number. I know it's probably in the seven figures, I would imagine. And if a team can take seven figures worth of, or whatever Michael McDowell's salary was, probably six figures. We know Landon Castle sued Harry Scott over $450,000. So you would assume Michael McDowell's is probably somewhere in that range. So if they can take that money and put it into making a car go faster, it makes perfect sense to hire Casey Kane.
Sure. Sure. Yeah, and so to Andrew's question here, Andrew Kansian.
Not me.
Not Andrew Sherwin sitting across from me. how do you see sponsors getting value on their investments? So I think this is a sponsor-focused question in terms of $600,000 a race. Was Farmers getting their value out of that? And is this something that...
Well, they sure as hell were in 2012 and 2013 when Casey was... like top five in every other race.
Sure. I think too, and this is where Nate was going with it, was maybe they don't have to spend as much with
That's
these
exactly where I'm going.
Yeah, with these younger drivers coming in. Maybe it just clicked for me, Nate. I'm a little slow.
That's okay. That's right.
But yeah. So maybe that's the whole point here, is we don't have to get that much. And so you get more value out of the sponsors by and large that they're not having to pay as much. And getting the same or similar.
Sponsor prices and values are like really hard to judge, I think, in NASCAR, because they vary, obviously, according to the company and what they're looking for and how they, you know, what metrics they look at to determine if they're getting a return on their investment. And then the thing about sponsorships that always gets me is they're only worth what somebody is willing to pay for it. Mm-hmm. And a team can put a number and say, this is what it's going to cost to sponsor this driver, but it's like selling a house. If no one's going to give you that number, you're going to have to lower your price, right? And that's the trick. I think that's where it gets confusing, or you know, it's not really doesn't really line up with, I think, how things work. Aside from some real world examples for the common man, I don't think it lines up with professional sports in terms of corporate sponsorship and how it applies to NASCAR and race teams, looking to build budgets to be competitive.
Yeah, go ahead, Sherman.
Yeah, I've always said that about like baseball cards or any other trading card that you might collect, you know, be it on the nerd wing of Magic or on the ultra sports fan of football cards or even NASCAR cards. You know, baseball cards is something everybody pretty much mm-hmm. had if you're a sports fan, but it's only worth what someone will give you for it.
Sure. And so what's I'm intrigued to see what the contracts and stuff look like. Just to know, is it like does somebody like Hendrick pretty much have these line items that are like, if you want this exposure, you get this much. This exposure, you get, you know, you pay this much.
Like a rider.
Or does everybody go out to a bar and you know, Hendrick pays for the tab, and by the end of it, they've agreed on $600,000 a race, sure, why not? You know, I wonder how that works. But
that's how we want it to work.
Yeah. So with that, let's go ahead and gas it up. We're going to New Hampshire. We've talked about it.
Hampshire.
Boom, there it is.
That's what you say down south.
Yeah, the old Magic Mile. The boogers are back, as you said.
That's me. That's the boogers are back.
The boogers are back. The VHT, the slop, whatever we're calling it.
Oh, PJ won. And here's the thing.
Oh, that's
people freaked
that's
out.
That's branded, man.
Yeah. People freaked out when they went from VHT to PJ1, thinking that, like, oh, my God, what are all these weird, crazy things we're doing? Guess what? Somebody bought VHT's compound from them, and they rebranded it as PJ1. It's the same boogers.
So, yeah.
So, yep. Let's clear the air on that.
Yeah. Let's, call a booger a booger.
A booger is a booger.
Nate, tell us what you're looking forward to.
New Hampshire. Well, I think Toyota's probably going with an edge based on the way the July race went. And just based on recent history, although Harvick won the race there a year ago, I think Toyotas have won two or three of the last four. There was a time when Penske was dominant, I think in 2014. Kenseth should have won the race in July. Ham won one. Harvick won a year ago. Kenseth won the July race a year ago. So, I think you'll see some of the familiar names up front, and we'll see if the traction compound, which is the neutral terminology that I prefer, rather than any corporate compound branding that can be sold here and there by other people, we'll see if it has an impact.
Sure enough.
I loved it.
Yeah, go ahead.
No, I'm sorry. I don't have anything like pre-programmed.
No. What I was going to say, what I really like about the playoffs, especially after this first round that we've already had over, we've sort of set the field now. We've talked about, and Nate said it, who are the people that need to be worried the most? The people in the bottom four. What I really like about this is that the story isn't about who's up front right now. It's about that bottom eight or so that are trading places and are 10 points from each other, et cetera, et cetera. I really like that we're focusing there and we're not, going to be focusing up front as much. We're going to be seeing for this race and the next race, any time before one of the cutoffs. But I think especially in the second, starting with the second race of each of these stages, that we get to see this focus on that bottom four, eight, whatever it is in that round.
Yeah, sure. Like the two that are currently in and the two that are on the out and have right to try to replace those guys. No, that's great. Especially at a track like Loudon, where we love the place where it is. We love the racetrack. Last 4 or 5 years has not produced very good racing outside of one of those crazy late race cautions that NASCAR has been trying to get away from because people have said, we don't like that.
Mm-hmm.
We know TV likes that, but as fans, we don't like that.
Mm-hmm.
So it'll be interesting to see how it plays out. But yeah, you got eight guys that are trying for four spots. And I don't know, when we go to Dover next week, isn't that Jimmy's thing? Like, there aren't going to be eight drivers that could win a race at Dover. There's going to be about four.
Mm-hmm.
At Loudon, there's probably eight guys that could win.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what's going to make it more interesting.
Yeah, yeah. So, am I crazy, Nate, on the playoffs? Or is that a nice, bonus for the system?
Yeah, no, I agree with you. I think last year at this race, this was where Austin Dillon, who again is right on the cusp of maybe not advancing, I think he went into this race, and I think he may have wrecked in practice or something. I think he went to a backup car or spun or something. He rebounded and like got like a top 20 in this race, and then he got the top 10 at Dover that advanced him, and that made, I remember, being in the pits at Dover last year, and that being like a really a nice little feel good story. I mean, obviously, he didn't make it beyond the second round, but he made it to the through the first round when a lot of people weren't expecting him to. That made for a good story, and I think you're right. I think the focus does shift a little bit. And certainly, you're keeping an eye on who the contenders are, but this is a 1 mile flat track that, even though it's similar in size to Phoenix, I don't think a lot transfers anywhere else. I mean, maybe Martinsville is a little bit similar to New Hampshire, but I don't think they're all that similar. So I don't think like who wins this race is necessarily going to tell you a lot about who's going to be dominant. But and that's why I think you're right. I think the focus on who is in position and who is in a precarious spot entering the cutoff race at Dover coming out of here is going to be a lot of the focus.
Yeah, yeah. Sherwin, we promised it earlier in the podcast that we would talk about car number 13. It is episode 113.
Yep, driver 13. Driver and we have a 13. Very special driver 13.
We do. Before we get to him, I want to note, unlucky number 13 in the Cup Series has never won.
Holy crap.
Yeah.
I almost said the other word.
Yeah, he almost said the other word, and it deserves it. No wins. Listen to this. Eight top fives for the number 13 car. In the history
Benica
of NASCAR,
had that.
Yeah, exactly. That's what I'm saying. How crazy is? Is it self perpetuating? I don't know what it is that the number 13 car. Oh,
there's a reason why every elevator in America, you get in there and there ain't no 13th floor.
Right. Everybody on 14 knows what's up, though.
They know
what's
up. When you get 14th floor, do you not go back down to the desk and go, how about 15, brother?
I know what's up here. But yeah, it's that was crazy to me. And the people who've run it, Casey Mears, Max Pappas, Ty Dillon, you would think Casey Mears has eight top fives.
That famous car they always throw back to, that Smokey Unic, not the gray ghost, but they're those same colors as the gray ghost, that black and with the gray side 13 car they like to throw back to. Like, that car didn't win?
Right.
Smokey's car didn't win?
And didn't top five, evidently. Which is crazy. With all that said, last week, we lost a member of the racing community. We got to go hats off and drinks up again.
Hats off.
Ted Christopher drove the number 13 a few times in Cup and several times in Xfinity. Legend in New England as a modified racer. Hey, he was known for his, he called it his three-tap rule. First tap was, I'm here. Second tap was, hey, get out of the way.
Hey, brother.
And third tap was not a tap. That was the see ya.
Fourth tap's the see ya.
Yeah.
And the other thing about him was, he was an American badass
mm-hmm.
as a modified racer. And he lost his life, in a plane early. He was only 59 yep. years old.
Yeah,
so
yeah,
that's
crazy.
Tough.
Nate, have you had any interaction with Ted at all or any stories that you knew?
You know, I don't have a personal story per se, but when I remember that I used to work at the Richmond Times-Dispatch, the Richmond newspaper covering NASCAR, and I remember that I saw a win by Ted Christopher in a modified race at Richmond when Richmond still had the mods. And so I looked it up, and it was 1999 at Richmond. It might have been like the modified's a little stretch where they raced at Richmond for four or five seasons. It might have been the first year of that. Anyway, Ted Christopher won that race in 1999, and I had no idea until I went back and looked it up. That was his first modified career victory.
Holy crap.
It was in 99. And he was, you guys just said it, I mean, he was 41 years old then. And
yeah.
That tells you about, people talk about what a hard-nosed racer he was. I mean, the majority of his modified success came during his mid to late 40s, which I think is really cool and really impressive. I'm sure there'll be some special tributes this weekend, given a lot of the fans at New Hampshire Motor Speedway. Yeah. I'm sure people who saw him race in person many times around New England.
He started getting success at age 41. So you're saying there's a chance for old Rusty here.
There's always a chance.
Yeah. So I think probably one of the coolest things is, racing doesn't generally retire numbers.
Mm-hmm.
Richie Evans had his, they retired his number across all factions of the sport that Richie Evans participated in. The track that, that Ted Christopher participated in the most, they're going to retire his number at his track. Nobody's ever going to be able to run the 13 again at his track. And that's really cool.
That's neat.
We love that support from a grassroots perspective. Because I think that's what everybody's trying to generate again now is get that grassroots stuff going. So that's pretty cool.
All right. With that, Sherwin, real quick. So prior to coming over here and getting on the show, you were on a little bit of another show going on. Now we don't want any spoilers yet, but what's going on?
No spoilers indeed. But Brandon Crowd from Lap Traffic.
Yep.
That great podcast over there, they're doing up out of Detroit, Motor City. We went head-to-head on the My Opinion and Therefore Fact NASCAR podcast.
Oh, a couple friends guys across the lake?
Across the pond. Andrew and David over there. I joked that there was too many Andrews involved in this deal. But we did a little bit. I think you can expect to hear my ugly voice either Tuesday or Wednesday of next week. And I almost tied Charles Crawl, who's a great friend of ours, ARCA announcer and huge supporter of everything NASCAR and stock car racing for that matter.
Mm-hmm.
So I almost got there. I beat Brandon though.
Spoiler alert. Okay, so with that, we get to our Strange Mustang. Nate, you've been on here before. You know what this is all about. Ashley J. Stang sent us something off the wall here. She says, I like this, Sherwin.
It's funny.
Who do you think has the worst haircut in NASCAR of 2017? And who has the best haircut in NASCAR in 2017? Sherwin, I'm going to answer this with the same person. Ryan Blaney.
It's funny you say that because I'm going to go with Eric Jones.
Eric Jones, okay.
He's got that Tennessee waterfall working good.
I like it.
And it's terrible at the same time.
I think that's something with rednecks, that the worst and the best is pretty much the same thing. What do you
Well,
if you're proud enough to wear that,
of the bell curve can in fact be the same thing. All you got to do is fold that paper.
Fold that paper over, go around the earth one time, you'll end up at the other side. Nate, any haircuts this year that have stood out for you?
I naturally, you can't look past Erik Jones in the mullet, but I'm going to plead the fifth on worst because I have to cover these guys for a living. So
that makes
sense. That's the best, though.
I love it. Well, with that, I mean, what can I say, man? It's great to be back in the saddle again, in the seat, ready to do it again sometime soon. Let's not wait another 3 weeks.
Yeah, I'll just ask you live on the podcast.
Let's do it.
Can we do it Tuesday?
I'm sure we can do it Tuesday. What's wrong with Tuesday? Why not Tuesday?
I'll get us a guest.
Excellent.
Nate, Jeff Gluck.
Right on. Nate, close us out. Tell us what's going on, where people can find you, and what you're up to, and what we can look forward to.
NBCSports.com/NASCAR obviously is where we post our stories. Have a column up there tomorrow. Podcast every Wednesday, NASCAR NBC podcast available. Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Google Play, Spotify, anywhere you get your podcast, you can find it. I really appreciate your guys' support of that. And then I will be on Victory Lap this weekend if anybody cares to watch. That's after the race.
Excellent.
On NBCSN on Sunday.
Oh, cool. I will be looking forward to that.
Yeah. So your podcast, and I mean, I look forward to a lot of them. I listen to a lot of them. Mm-hmm. I don't really want to rank and compare them all because they all mean something different to me.
But they're all different. Yeah, that's what's great about it. They all have their own niche, right? Yeah.
I love listening to your podcast. I love to support it. It's awesome.
Nate, any teasers? Anybody like guests or topics or what's going on?
I can give you a couple that are coming up that are in the can. I sat down with Tony Gibson a couple weeks ago.
Cool.
A ton of great stories about Alan Kulwicki because he was on that team that won the 92 championship. So stay tuned for that. That is coming. I sat down recently with the lead engineer. I think I can't remember her exact title. She essentially oversees Hendrick Motorsports engineering vehicle dynamics. Her name is Diane Hall, and she worked in F1, she worked in IndyCar, she's worked all around the world. She has a fascinating story, and I talked to her for a while on Tuesday, and that went well, so that'll be coming up.
Can I get her number, please?
Oh man.
Sorry.
And besides looking forward, looking back, the podcast with Danica Patrick, holy crap. If you hadn't got enough props on that yet, which I think the whole community has sort of rallied around, that was really cool.
Thanks. Appreciate that, man.
Awesome.
Yeah.
Awesome. So, with that, Sherwin, let's start closing this thing out.
Are we going to play the music?
Here comes music. Look there. I've already got it ready already. I remembered how to podcast by the end of this thing.
I barely did.
I know, right? We all know where to find us. PTM Podcast at PTM Podcast.
Stay with us, Nate, for about another 30 seconds.
PTMPodcast.com. Just search PTM Podcast.
Yeah, Instagram, YouTube, it's all there. It's all the same.
Yeah, y'all know where to find me, Rusty Wallace at Tailgate Mayor.
And you know where to find me, pregame engineer Andrew Sherwin.
All right, we'll talk to y'all next Tuesday, evidently.
Tuesday.
Thanks for joining. We'll talk to y'all later.
Silhouette.